just starting on the top of Teda Morales. There's a Gemara starts here with a statement of Rav Huna Amar. A question about what Rav Huna exactly is addressing, right, it is unclear. Rashi claims that Rav Huna is addressing the question that we had earlier in the Gemara, which is the stira between Metav by Aretz and by Kesef or Shava Kesef, right, that you're allowed to use any type of monetary equivalent. So we've given previous answers. Rashi says Rav Huna is actually answering that same question, but the Gemara had interrupted in the interim because of the question of Bishalohen Shamim, right, or whether Benizak Shamim, Benamazak Shamim, because that was one of the answers we gave. So we did that whole sugya, and now we're back to that question again. In addition, the Rif seems to be learning this way. Tosfos suggests a different explanation, slightly different explanation, and he adds in the word Amar Rav Huna in order to have it be a separate memo or a new statement, and we'll work through it. I'll read it as Rashi does, and then we'll come back and look at it as Tosfos does. So says, Rav Huna Amar, O Kesef, O Metav, meaning that there's basically a choice that, of what you can pay. You can either pay Kesef, or you can pay Metav Aretz, meaning that those two are considered to be equivalent. There's no difference, meaning that those are equally good ways to compensate. Right, the obvious problem already is that he didn't address the problem. Right, the problem was not Metav versus Kesef, it was Metav versus Shava Kesef, Afilu Subin. Right, so all he addressed was Kesef and Metav. That's it. Eitz Beirav Nachman Rav Huna Yashiv, the Rabot Shava Kesef, Afilu Subin. I mean that you're not addressing what the main issue is that it's not just money. If it was just money, we could solve it that way, but that's not the answer. So when it says, Achra Mayaskinen Bidaletle, that he doesn't have money. He doesn't have anything else. So where it says, Itzaletle Shita. Of course, if he doesn't have anything else, what if we can't demand him to pay something that he doesn't have? So where it says, Maudutema, Aminin Le Zil Tarach Zavit. We could say, Vaitzaletle Kesef. We could make a demand on him to liquidate, monetize the item that he wants to pay with, and then deliver cash. But instead, Kamash Glan, we say that it's fine if he hands him, right, whatever he owes him through these monetary equivalents, right, that he can hand them soup in, bran, anything that gets him to the value of the hezek that he did, and he does not have to show up with the kesef and the metav. So now, at this point, right, Rashi says that's the conclusion of Rav Huna's statement of solving our problem between metav and kesef or shava kesef. So basically, you have two choices up front, which are metav and kesef. If you don't have those, then we say, okay, you can pay with shava kesef. So that's the way Rashi learns. Rav Huna, the Rif suggests also that this answer of Rav Huna actually argues, right, on the answers that we saw earlier, that Rav Huna is raised Rav Yeshua, Rav Papa earlier on, and therefore, right, this is a machlokas between them, three machlokas, and he paskins alocha, Rav Papa, Rav Huna, Rav Yeshua, which are the later Amoraim. Now, the Rabbeinu Tam says that's not the case. You know why that's not the case? Because he says, by Nezikin, there are actually three dinim. By Nezikin, there are three possibilities. One is, O Kesef, O Metav. Right? That means that the first option is Kesef or Metav. That's what you have to pay for Nezikin. A backup is, Eletle. If he doesn't have anything, then he can pay with Subin or Shavu Kesef. But that is only true when it comes to Nezikin. That is not true by a Baal Chol. And we've seen Tosus when we learned in, I think, Subos and other places, we saw the Rabbeinu Tam making the same comment. And when it comes to borrowing money, when it comes to a Baal Chol, a debtor, the obligation is to first and foremost pay with cash and only cash. When he lent you money. And when he expects to get back, it's either money, right, and if he has to take collateral and he has to go in and get it, okay, that he has to do against his will, maybe even land. But what he expects back is kesef and nothing else. And that you don't have a right to use other options. And if he comes along and he says, I want to give you subin, right, because that's worth money, he, the debtor himself, will have to liquidate it and monetize it and give him cash. Because that's the debtor's obligation to show up with cash to repay the loan. Which is not necessarily true by Nezikin. And that's the chiddush here about Nezikin, is that he is not obligated to create the liquidation, and he can hand him the subin instead of actually giving him cash. So Rabbeinu Tam differentiates between, right, first of all, differentiates between Nezikin and Baal Chol. On the other hand, he disagrees with the Rish over here that the psak is like the other Amoraim, but he says the Pesach like Rav Huna over here, that differentiates between Kesef and Meitav, which are your first options, and the Subin, which are a secondary option if you don't have the one of the first two options. Now the Gemara has a statement of Rav Asi. So Amar Rav Asi, Ksafin Harehen Kikarko. The Kesef is the equivalent to Karka. It would help us with that. Our Rashi earlier on, remember when Rashi was discussing the difference between Meitav and Shavu Kesef, he says that Meitav or Art is Kesef. So it's the same thing here. The Gemara is saying that the statement of Vati, that Kesef equals Karka, right? That equals the equivalent of land. The Gemara says, my Hilchoso. Okay, fine. What Halacha is that telling us? Elay Melanian Meitav. If it's a teacher, then Meitav. Hainu de Rav Huna. That's exactly what Rav Huna just said above. Right? Rav Huna said above. Then why don't we say the Gemara should have read Bechain Amar Rav Asi? Right? It should be a continuation of the previous statement. I say Rav Asi also says a similar thing. Ella, so must be known for a case like this. Two brothers divide up the land. One takes land and one takes money. They have a Yerusha from their father. So instead of dividing all the property equally, you mean that half the property, half the property, half the money, half the money. One of them says, I'll take all the property. One of them says, I take all the cash. Now the Baal Chov comes back, and the Baal Chov is only entitled to take, after the father's dead, is from land, right? He only can take it from the real property. So he goes and takes the land. That's a high. Mar says, well, because the brother who took karka can now go back and take half the money away from the brother who took the money. So Mar says, Peshitta. Right? I mean, that's, now we're suggesting that's the statement of Rav Asi, that money and karka are equal. Right? So if money and karka are equal, then therefore he can go back and make a claim again. Mar says, Peshitta.
Even if they're not equal,
they can do it. Right? High bro, the high love bro. I mean, right. One of them's a brother, and one of them's a son, and one's not a son. I mean, that, of course, they're both, the father's estate is obligated to the debtor, and so why should one son take the burden, or carry the burden of that debt, without the other son? I mean, that there's no logic to suggest otherwise. The man says, no, ikadam, right? The son is the other abo. The logic's the other way, that there is a logic to differentiate why. The safim. He says, this is why we made such a division. We divided between money and land. Why? Because each of us took on a different responsibility. Why? I took Safim, di meganve, lo mishtam naminoch. Right? L'hochi shakel ara. Di metarpa, lo mishtam alach. Midei. Minai. He says that, why did we split according to the lines of money and land? Because I said money can be stolen. It's a movable property, it's metalkalin. And therefore, I took money and I say, I'm responsible if someone steals it. If someone comes and steals the money from me, I'm not going to go back to you and make a claim, give me half the karka. And you took karka knowing that what? If it gets taken by some sort of debtor, then I'm not going to come back to you and make a claim against you. And that's exactly why we did the differentiate this way. Ella, so what's going to be the chiddush? Ella shnei achim shechilku. It's a different case. It's two achim that split. This is a different case. Two brothers split, but they split property, and they split the property equally. Then a debtor comes and takes the property of one of the two brothers. Right? So the man says, okay, what's the chiddush over here?
The thing is, they have to divide
the property. Right? Right? Then we already have this statement from Vasi that says that they have to go and redivide the property. The brothers that come and split up the estate, and then a creditor comes and makes a claim against the estate and takes one of the property of one of them. Rav Amar Betela Machloket. Rav says that we go and what? We annul the original division and we redivide the property with what's left. Shmuel Amar Viter. What's done is done. I mean, the division is done, what he took is done, and we leave the split the way it is. Ravati Amar Notel Revia Bekarka or Revia Bima'ot. He takes the Revia Bekarka, Revia Bima'ot. I'll come back and explain this because Rashi has two ways to explain this. If you're still trying to explain this Revia Bekarka, Revia Bima'ot. Rav Amar Betela Machlokes. Rav says that we annul the original division. Why? Kasavar Ha'akim Shechoku Koyorshim Habu. Right, brothers that divide up are the equivalent of inheritors. When they divide the property up, it's the equivalent of being Yorshim, and therefore it's as if the estate in some way, it's still intact. When they're considered Yorshim, when they divide the property, they're still considered as if that property was designated for them, If that property is designated for them, it's as if there was never really any split of the estate. As if the estate still exists as a whole or a unit, and therefore there's some imbalance in the division because of this creditor coming in a claim, we go and redivide it, right, according to the new allocation of the estate. Ushmul Amar Viter. Shmuel says, no, that once the division is done, what's done is done. Why? Kasavar Achim Shechilku Lukuchot. That when brothers divide up the estate, when they say, you take this, I'll take that, you take this, instead of taking half of everything, right, once you do that, that's the equivalent of being purchasers. Right? That's the equivalent of being buying the land. So he's a purchaser. If he's a purchaser, purchasers don't have recourse against each other. They only have recourse against the, quote unquote, the estate. Ukeach shelo b'achrayuta. Right? But when it comes to being lokeach, they are a lokeach without recourse. They're buying, and they have no recourse, and therefore, once the land is divided, the creditor comes, too bad. Whatever you took, you took. Whatever you lost, and there's no redivision of the property. Ravasi Amar, noten l'revia b'karka, for l'revia b'ma'ot, you take a quarter or a quarter, or maybe a quarter or a quarter. Misveikalei is a safek iki yorshin dami, iki l'kuchot damu. Right, he says he has a safek between whether the luck is like, right, Rav, or the luck is like Shmuel. And therefore, yokach, notel l'revia b'karka, l'revia b'ma'ot. Now, what is this Revia Bakarko Revia Ma'ot? So Rashi brings two interpretations. The first interpretation Rashi brings is Revia Bakarko Revia Ma'ot means either or. Either he gives him a quarter in Karko, or he gives him a quarter in Ma'ot. Not that he's giving a total of half, but rather he's only giving him a quarter. Why is he only giving him a quarter? Because he has a safek right now. You have, say for instance, let's call it, each brother got 100, right, units of land. Then one brother, if a creditor comes along and takes his 100. Now what's left with one brother is 100. If you split the estate evenly now, they should each get 50 and 50. The problem is, what I have a safek. According to Shmuel, all of the 100 will stay with the brother that's there because what's done is done. According to Rav, we would split it 50-50 because Rav says it's annulled, the original division's annulled, and then we go back now and redivide the property up, so it'd be 50 and 50. So now what I have a safek. Right, and what's the din? It's a mamon and mutal b'safek. If it's a mamon and mutal b'safek, it's chokin. Right, when there's a mamon that we have a doubt about which way to go, we split the difference. So now, according to both parties, according to Shmuel and Rav, 50 of it definitely belongs to the brother that's holding on to the 100 right now. Right, either way, 50 belongs to him. The only thing that's a question now is the 50 that needs to go to the other brother. That's the part that's in safek. That 50 is in safek. If I split that in half...
According to who is safek?
According to Ravasi. So safek, because he says he's not sure if the luck is like Shmuel or Rav. So that 50 is in safek, so I would give a quarter. Because it's mamon mutal b'safek, I give half of it. So I give a quarter. That's what Rashi is suggesting, that the quarter means either a quarter of karka or a quarter of ma'ot. Meaning that karka and ma'ot are equal. Right? But
this is the same, they're equal.
And then I can give a quarter of either ma'ot or karka. And I can pay him off, meaning that I pay him because I'm in safek, but I keep 3/4, he keeps 75, and I keep 25 for the brother that was claimed from. That's the first lashon of Rashi. The Rashi brings the second lashon, which says that Revi'im and Mamot means both a quarter in Karka and a quarter in Kesef, right? Meaning it doesn't mean or, but really means and. Give them a quarter in Karka. Then why? Why? Because that's because the Ma'ot is like Karka, right? But we are safek whether they're like Yorshim. Right, and he has to give him back. Yorshim means I have to give you back the land, because if we're really Yorshim, then my entitlement is actually to half the land, not the money, not to pay me out and say I keep the land, you get the money, but rather my entitlement is actually half of the karka. On the other hand, right, if you're a lukuach, right, if you're a lokeach and buying, right, and lokeach be'achrayut, my advisor is going to hold that as a lokeach with recourse, then I have the ability not to, right, if you buy from me with recourse, I don't have to give you new land to replace the land that was taken. All I have to do is pay you the equivalent kesef of what you paid me for the original karka. I can pay you off in money. So now, that's what Ravasi's suffix is. Are they the kukul or the yorshim? What is the entitlement of the brother who lost the property to? Is he entitled to get half the land? Or is he entitled to get money, or only money, because he got it with recourse? So that's what Ravasi says. Motel mamon motel for suffix, or the suffix here, whether he's a yoresh or the kuach. So what does he do? The 50 that he owes him, he gives him half of it in money, and half of it in karka. So that's how he used to get it. That's why you get a quarter of, he actually has to give him a full 50, but we're not sure that payment to 50, is it a payment in cash or payment in karka? So he gives him half in karka and half in kesef. Rashi gives that second, and he says, V'loshon roshon shamati. He says, I heard the first lashon, the original lashon, which would be simply a little more like, or that saying that karka is equivalent to kesef. Right? In the second case, he's not really saying karka is equivalent to kesef. He's saying that there's two options. I mean, there's two different issues. One you can pay with the kesef, one you pay with the karka. As obvious that they're equal, it's just that there are two options because of the different scenarios, and because of the scenarios, you give them half in each. The first one really says that the two are equivalent. Either you pay the quarter karka or you pay the quarter ma'ot.
It doesn't say oh.
Right, but Rashi brings it to other places like in Yuvamot. The Mishnah says that Chalat Vatsaba Mamar Venatan Get Uba'al. There it doesn't mean and. It means or. Right? So we have these statements in the Gemara in Yuvamot where the Gemara uses the Vava Chibur even to mean or. Right? Rashi thought of your question obviously because the way they give it in the Gemara, and he says that we do have instances where Vav means or. All right, now, so the Gemara says Ela Mai Harihen Kekarka. So what does it mean now that they are like karka? The inyan meitav, right? That they are. What does it mean they're like karka? That means that they're the equivalent of meitav. Where it says ihochi haidus Rav Huna. Again, if you say that the whole idea here is that ketzef equals karka, right? Then all you've done now is said the same thing Rav Huna did originally in the beginning of this Gemara. And again, it should have read v'chein amach, right? Ihochi haidus Rav Huna. Then Rav Ashi is saying the same thing as Rav Huna. The Gemara is Ema, then you do. And Yochanan is saying the same thing. And amend the Gemara to read V'chein Amar Rav Ashi. That's the conclusion of that section of the Gemara. Now we have a new statement, right, which is beginning a new part of the Gemara. Amar Rav Zeira, Amar Rav Huna. So this is the name of Rav Huna. B'mitzvah al shlish. When you do a mitzvah, you have to give up to a shlish to do the mitzvah. The Gemara says, my shlish. What does it mean to do a shlish? Even my shlish beito. That any time it comes to doing a mitzvah, that you would have to give one third of your net worth to perform the mitzvah. If all of a sudden now he has three mitzvot that come to him at once, right? Then that's it. He has to give all his net worth to perform the mitzvot. I mean, at least, if you didn't come in order, you could what's called these two rights of the rabbi. You could have the one tenth of rabbi, which means that every time you take a third of a lesser total, at least he would have something left. But if they all come at once, then he wipes them out, and he has now used up all of his house. That doesn't seem like a reasonable solution. El Amr of Zera, Behidur Mitzvah Ad Shlish. Right, Hidur Mitzvah is, we say Ad Shlish, I'm sorry, the Mitzvah, until one third of the Mitzvah. So what does that mean until one third of the Mitzvah? By Ravashi. What does that mean that you have to add a Shlish for Hidur Mitzvah? So Ravashi says, is that a Shlish Milagav, or a Shlish Milapar? Right, so now we, traditionally, when we look at percentages or fractions, when we add something up, we always look at things as what's called shlish milagav, right? That our mindset, the way we think about it, is if I tell you pay 1/3 more, you would take whatever number it is and add a third from that number. Say, for instance, six, something that was worth 6 shekel. You would come along, I say you pay 30%, 33% more. You would say now, I would pay 8 shekel. I take 2 out of the 6, right? That's 1/3 of it. That's 8 shekel, that's what's called shlish milagav. The Gemara has another possibility, is that shlish, when I say a third, now again, the people, look, it's plausible, we have a mindset like this, but if it was always defined this way, you would think of shlish the same way. But a shlish does not mean a shlish of the original principle, but the new principle, the addition that you make, will be 1/3, right, of the amount. So what do? So if you have 6, the answer would be 9. Because the new 3, right, if I add 3 to it, that 3 is 1/3 of the total new principle. It's not of the original principle, but the total new principle, that is 1/3. That's called shlish milabar. Just a quick
margin.
Right. Same thing. And the easy way to always do it, by the way, is whenever the Gemara uses this milabar, is just to drop the denominator one number. If you say that I've taken a third, right, milabar, all you have to say is that 1/2. You multiply by half. It means 6 times 1/2 will give you 3. Right, every time. If they say a quarter milabar, it means really 1/3. You just drop the denominator one number, that'll give you the equivalent value, right, of what you're trying to accomplish. Just a quick way to do it whenever you see it in the Gemara. Now,
what's the word milabar mean?
Milabar means from the outside. Milagav means from the inside, meaning the actual principle. Milabar means when the new principle on the outside, meaning that it generates the new principle. Right, so that's my take away. I don't know which one. Bimarova, Amrei Mishmei de Rabbi Zera, in the West, in Eretz Yisrael, they said the name of Rabbi Zera, Ashlish Mishado, right, 1/3, up to 1/3 comes out of his pocket. Right, Mitam Veilech, I mean, there's no cap. It's not a cap of Shlish for Mitzvah, but what? Mitam Veilech, you pay more than 1/3 for do either Mitzvah, Bishelha, Kodesh Baruch Hu. That a Kodesh Baruch Hu will repay you, meaning that he will give you back the money in this world, plus you'll keep the reward. So your upper shlish is on your expense, right, on your expense account. After that, it's on Akkadish Baruch Hu who explains the cap. The difference between the first lashon was that a shlish was a cap, a ceiling on how much you paid. And according to Marava and Eretz Yisrael, there was no cap, but it was, you were only really on the hook, we would say, right? You wouldn't get repaid or reimbursed for the first third, but after that you get reimbursed in Olam Hazeh. That's the way, right, that the Gemara reads. Now, what exactly a shlish and a hidur mitzvah is, right, is somewhat questionable. It's very, very vague here. Rashi, when he reads it, he says, "Vidur mitzvah shlish b'mitzvah, shemotzeg beis sifrei torot liknot." He's going to buy a sefer Torah. He sees two sifrei Torah. Bechad hadur mechavera. One is nicer than the other one. Yosif shlifa damim, but yikachat ha'agur. He should add on a third. If it's only a third more expensive, then he should buy the better one. Otherwise, he can leave it out. Why? It's Daniel. We have a zekei livan behu. Zekei livan behu means hitna elafanav b'mitzvot. That you have to do, right? You have to beautify the mitzvot in front of him. Rashi gives examples: the filafas, the sefer Torane, ulavne, talitne, tzitzitne, and all of these items that are included under hidur mitzvah. There are other items that are included sometimes, like on Chanukah, right? We say them a menorah yafe, even though that's not the actual mitzvah itself. Even though that's only a ma'afsher, a hefsher mitzvah, that sometimes, right? Some that we see the term hidur mitzvah show up, right? And even again, with some things like talit na'eh. Talit na'eh, the mitzvah itself is just to wear tzitzit. A talit na'eh, right, again, it's something that's a makshir of a mitzvah, not a mitzvah itself. So you see Rashi including that in... Right, you see Rashi including that in the hidur mitzvah, the category of hidur mitzvah. Not just the mitzvah itself, but something that's makshir, or you know, I mean, that is a hekshir of a mitzvah. So that too is, right, those too might be under this category of hidur mitzvah. Now, Tosfos brings down brings down over here. If you say actually should be mitzvah, and Tosfos says perishim at the etrog kegos kamosh yirah chachamim. That he finds the etrog at the minimum shear of the chachamim, which is an egos ve'chad gadol mimenu, and another one that's bigger than it. Right, shlish, right, mimenu shlish ikneu, he should buy it. Tosfos seems to be indicating that this is not a question of monetary increase in what you do, but rather it's talking about the minimum shi'ur that's obligated to do a certain mitzvah. And if I'm at that minimum shi'ur, right, if he has the ability to find something up to a third bigger than it, then we say, go ahead and get that bigger. I mean, if there's a minimum shi'ur bedrog, we say, go ahead and take shlish mitzvah, go out and try to find something that is one third bigger than the smallest shi'ur that's out there. And that becomes a general question, right, for the Rishonim. And even the halacha is, how do you define hidur mitzvah? First of all, is hidur mitzvah subjective or objective? That question can be asked anywhere. It means that there's an objective standard, which a little bit what Tosfos might be hinting at, is that there is a objective line or a shiur, and then every person then can add one third or add to the hidur mitzvah. But it's not subjective that if you would have bought this etrog, then go ahead and now buy an etrog that is one third greater than it. Right, that baseline is set objectively, and then one third above that, hidur mitzvah would be the same for everybody. Or is it subjective hidur mitzvah? Subjective from the fact that I normally would go out and spend 100 shekel on my etrog. Now I should go out and spend 130 shekel, or depending on 150, right, shekel, depending on, right, which way, from the gavon of the bar. So I should spend that more. But someone else normally would have spent, right, 200 shekel or 300 shekel on their etrog, then their hidur mitzvah is 400 or 450 shekel. And it'll be depending on what my normal baseline is. That it sometimes becomes difficult because we don't really know. Where do you set that level? You start looking at your etrogim, what is really your baseline to set up with the hidur mitzvah?
Because you also buy candles with candles, not with oil.
Right, so it's not so simple, right? Then once you get a subjective at how you define or how you define what is the baseline for hidur mitzvah. And lastly, there is also maybe an aspect of hidur mitzvah that's personal. Meaning that, is there an objective standard for what is beautiful? I mean, even in etrogim, for instance, when you look at an etrog, right, there are different, if you look at an etrog and it's beautiful to you, even though that to somebody else, they look at it and they see some other psulim in it that bother them. I mean, of course, halachically it's a kosher etrog, but you look at this etrog and you see it's more beautiful, even though there might be something on it, maybe a little green that somebody else would say that's problematic. Because you personally believe that it's a better etrog, that makes it hidur mitzvah. Whereas hidur mitzvah, again, an objective standard by a halachic hidur mitzvah. Which means it doesn't matter what you think or how beautiful it is, but we're looking at a halachic standard of what is hidur mitzvah. Right? Like David was suggesting, meaning that lighting with oil versus candles, wax candles, is a halachic, right, hidur mitzvah, because the nace was done to oil, right, the shem zayit, and therefore we are ma'adif shem zayit. That's a hidur mitzvah that they look like to hear mitzvah, not because you like oil better, or because oil lights better than candles, but rather because that they halachically define hidur mitzvah. So again, all these questions arise, I mean, it's not simple, in hidur mitzvah. Again, when does it apply to things that are not a mitzvah, to extra mitzvah, or to something that is after a mitzvah? Right? Number two, does it apply, right, to the monetary cost of the mitzvah, or to the shiur, right, the shiur of the mitzvah itself? I mean, that what's the minimum standard of shiur, and then if I go up above that. Number three, does it apply subjectively or objectively? I mean, is there an objective standard, and therefore hidur mitzvah is above that objective standard, or I set my own baseline, what I normally would have bought, and then I have to add on hidur mitzvah above that? Or less, right, is there, in hidur mitzvah, is it only halachic hidur mitzvah, or there's a hidur mitzvah even from what we call the ayin, right, your, what you see in your own eye, right? Is there such an idea of hidur mitzvah? All of these come up in the idea, in the concept of hidur mitzvah.
For some people,
right?
It's how much they say that answer.
Alright, the new Mishnah. Kol shekhafti bishmirato, heksharti et nitzko. Right, so now it says that anything that kol shekhafti bishmirato, I'm obligated to watch the item, meaning obligated to watch the item means that I now have to take care of this item. If heksharti et nitzko, then I was heksharti et nitzko. What this word heksharti means over here is unclear. Rashi brings two possibilities of what it means. It says the first possibility is that heksharti is zimanti oto hezet. I caused the damage. I mean, that if I'm obligated to watch it, then hefsharti nitzko, because I didn't watch it properly. Since I didn't watch, the damage happened because I didn't watch it properly, therefore I am obligated, or I caused, in a sense, the damage, and therefore I'm responsible for the damage by not watching. So hefsharti would be the same as zimanti, right? I made it, I prepared it, I caused it. Right? On the other hand, Rashi brings the second possibility of hefsharti, is that I have to rectify. The word hefsharti over here means the rectification, or remuneration, reimbursement. Right, I have to pay back the damage I did. So heksharti nitzko means that if I was obligated to watch it, then if they caused damage, heksharti nitzko, I'm now obligated to hakshir, to, you know, fix or to make better that which I caused damage to. Now, Numer brings the next line of the Mishnah. Where's heksharti b'miksat nitzko, chazachavti b'tashlume nitzko, kehekshar kol nitzko. So now, heksharti over here, right, has to be different than the heksharti that we used before. Because this heksharti is clearly I caused, right? That it was my fault. If I caused a portion of the damage, then I'm obligated in the total damage as if I caused all of the damage here. We'll deal with what does that mean. But here the Mishnah is at least proposing that if I caused half the damage, I'm now obligated in all of the damage. Right now, nechassim she'ein bahem mi'ilah, right? Where am I obligated to repay damages? That's only with items that don't have mi'ilah, meaning that only items that are not of hekdesh. If it belongs to Hekdesh, I'm not obligated in Nizakim. We saw that earlier, because it says Shor Re'eu, right, below Shor Hekdesh. Right, so that applies to all Nizakim, as we said before, that we have the, applies to all the Arbat and Nizakim, and we had the Pazuk Zerah Shava that helps us get around. But that means that when it comes to Hekdesh, there's no such thing as Nizak. Nichatin Shein Shel B'nei Brit. It has to be property of, right, other Jews that I'm obligated to. Afuke Nachri, as Rashi says. Nichatim Ham Yuchadim. They have to be owned property, meaning that they actually have owners. They have to have the property as owners, meaning that if the property is hefker, I'm not responsible to rectify the nezek. Again, that's obvious, but the Gemara will have to deal with what's the chiddush here of the Mishnah. First of all, I'm responsible for any damage I do, except in a place that belongs to the mazik. Meaning that if my animal entered into his property, and then his animal damages my animal, he can't be responsible for that. That's his own property. I didn't belong in there. And since I'm in there, I can't obligate him to pay for it. It's his property. Vereshuta nizak ve'amazik. In addition to that, a property that is jointly owned by the nizak and the mazik, again, the Gemara will have to explain why over there is the mazik exempted from compensation, from paying remuneration. Uke shechizik chava mazik, right? If the if he does damage, the mazik is chayav, right? The Gemara explained that the word chav here is in place of chayav, right? A mazik l'shalem tashlumei nezek b'meitavaris. He has to pay back shlumei nezek with the best of the land. This line was in our first Mishnah, but Rashi says in the first Mishnah we needed it, right? That was explained to us what you had to do, b'meitavaris. This second one was the extraneous one. If you remember earlier, we learned we learned to include that tuye teren. Right, that the Gemara brought this line of the Mishnah to say that we have a tuya karen according to Shmuel explained that it was shor and maveh was shein and regel, and we got karen from this part of the Mishnah. So Rashi back there said it was this Mishnah, the second time it appears in the Mishnah, not from our first Mishnah, the original Mishnah in the Masechta. Right, Tanu Rabanan. Kol shechapti b'shmirato efsharti et nisgo. And anything that I was obligated to watch, then I caused the damage by not watching it, or I'm obligated to remunerate the damage. Case, what's the case over here? Shor ubor shemash matnan l'shcher shote v'katan. I had a shore, my shore, or a boar that I dug, and then I gave it over to be watched by a cheresh shote v'katan. People who are not what we consider to be bardat or b'nei dat, I gave it to people who could not be responsible for these items. V'ezikot, and then they did damage. Chayav, l'shalem. And I'm obligated to pay for the damage because I basically didn't do what I was obligated to do, which is watch them. I gave them over to people who are unable to watch them. Masha enkin v'esh. This is not true when it comes to a fire. V'maya skinan. What's the case here? Ilayim of a shore kashur. So I had a shore that was tied up. Ubor mechuseh. And a boar that was covered. The kavata gabe esh. What would be the equivalent case by esh? Is a gachelet. Is a coal. And a coal that is, still hot, but it's slowly going down, right? It's slowly extinguishing. So my says, Mashna hocha. What's the difference? I mean that, why by shore and boar are you obligated? I mean that over there you did something, you tied the shore up, you covered the boar. And number two, in the ish, you gave the kharishot of cutting, gave them a coal. So you either should be equally culpable, right, or equally patur, meaning that you should be exempt. I mean, the two cases seem to be equivalent. Why is there a difference in between them? Ella bishor mutar.
Is that because with fire it can spread, whereas with a hot coal the only danger is simply standing on it?
Right. Or that he has to take an additional action to cause the fire, which he has to blow on it. A coal needs to be blown on in order to generate, right, a new flame or to cause the flame to spread, as opposed to an existing flame, which we're going to see in a second in the Gemara, that can spread by just bringing it to the fuel. Right. So Ella must be bishor mutar uvor migulet. As a case where what? He left the shore untied with his cherishot and gut, and he left the boar uncovered. The kavatab gabi esh, what would be the equivalent, right? This is the analysis of what you were saying. The equivalent by esh, by fire, would be shalhevet, a flame. The equivalent of having a flame. Mashain came by esh is the patur, right? What do you mean? By esh, that's patur. V'amar esh lakish, we have a Mishnah later on in the right, Masechta that says, Mishmei de Cheskia, lo that a cherishot and gutten. Eish, that was given to Chereshot HaKotan, you are Potter Midine Adam, V'chayib Midine Shemayim. You're Potter from being taken to court here, but you're Chayib Midine Shemayim. On that, Shmuel qualifies that statement. He says, Lo Shana, Lo Shemasa, Lo Gachelet V'liba. That only with qualification for that Mishnah where you're Potter is if you handed a coal to the Chereshot HaKotan, and then the Chereshot HaKotan went and blew on the coal to reignite the fire. Aval Shalhevet, if you hand him a flame, Chayab, you are obligated. So how can you say over here, Masha ain't came beish? Right, the equivalent of the case of a boar not being covered and a shore not being tied up is giving a chershot of cut and a flame. When you hand him a flame, you're responsible. Oh, in all those cases, you're chayav. So how come, again, there's a differentiation in the din? It's my time, huh? Why? The habari chazeka. Right, because it's so, I mean, that the headache is so obvious and so ready. When you hand him a flame, right, there's almost no chance that something won't be on fire afterwards. These are not b'nei dat, they have a flame. It's very easy for them to touch something that is flammable. So the Gemara says, look, the olam b'shor kashur, u'bor mechuseh. Sorry about here, a case where a shore is tied up, and a boar is mechuseh, the boar is covered. The kavataga b'esh gachelet. By an esh, that would be a equivalent of a coal. Alright, now you said above, fine. So coal, I understand why you're potter, because you'd have to blow on it to make it work. But why by a shore and a boar, you chayav, if you tied it up and you covered it? Now you did what you had to do, so why are you now chayav? It's a kamar. Maishna hocha. So why is there a difference in the din between esh and shore and boar? Where it says, shore, darkev and tuke. Shore, in general, will break out of its being tied up. And even when you tie it up, shore is a strong, wild, a little bit of a wild animal. And if you leave it tied up, especially with a cherish, shoten katan, there's a likelihood that this shore will break away from being tied up. Boar, darkev and tuke. Also a boar, generally the cover or that which is on top of it will get kicked away, moved away from the, right, the boar itself. So since that is the natural course of events that will happen, then even if the Chereshot and Katan did it themselves, right, since it would happen even without them, if they go ahead and do it, Rashi says, even if they themselves do it, it's already considered as if it was done because you left it in a state that would naturally, dissolve or deteriorate. that they would have deteriorated, the state would have deteriorated anyway without the Kershot Bekadon. If the Kershot Bekadon go and do it, you are responsible because you left them with a bad Shmirah to start with. Since you left them with a bad Shmirah, you're culpable in all of these cases. Tell it, Kamo, the Shavik La, Amya, Amya, Vazla. Exactly. By call, right, the situation, right, if it's left alone, in a sense, will only get better, which is, right, it will extinguish itself. So therefore, it takes an action by the Kershot Bekadon to reignite or to restart the process, and that you don't have to expect. I mean, that's not something that you have to really think about or consider, about. Tosfos disagrees with Rashi and says that that's not the case. Actually, Tosfos says over here, the near the forest, the darkle and tuke is a perish. That means that Rashi says that there's two independent things. One is that a shore naturally will come untied, and a bore will naturally become uncovered. Therefore, you're culpable even if they do it. But Tosfos says no. If you leave these types of items with the perishos and cut them, the most likely outcome is that the shore will be untied and the bore will be uncovered. Because that's what they do. Right? That they tend to, you know, move around, play around, think they can walk the shore, think they can uncover the boar. I mean, they're not B'nai Das, and therefore they get involved in these items, and they'll end up uncovering and untying it. Which is not true, in general, with the Kachelet, right, that they don't generally blow the coal, because the coal naturally is extinguishing, and that is not kind of play around and blow on a coal, first of all, Tach, right, and it's not the natural way. So this is all about Kereshot V'Kata, and Rashi says that it's an independent idea that this will naturally happen, and then Kershot Bekadon, you're culpable because of their of your lack of Shmirah that you put there. Ulu Rabbi Yochanan. Well, what about Rabbi Yochanan? We explained over in by the Mishnah that's further on in the Gemara, Shmuel's qualifications of the Mishnah. When are you patur by Eish? That's only when you hand them a coal. If you hand them a flame, you're chayav. There's another opinion over there, which is Rabbi Yochanan's opinion. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, Afilo Masalo Shel Heaven. Even if you hand them a flame, right? Nami Patur. He's also Patur. The Kavatol Hocha. Now how you can explain our statement over here. The Hocha B'Shor Mutar U'Bor Megula. Over here we're talking about a shore that's not tied and a bor that's open. Maishna Hocha, Maishna Hocha. Why over there are you Patur? And over here you are Chayah. Where it says, Hatam Sabto B'Kharish Kagarim. Over there the Sabto, and the word Sebet, right, means either the holding of the Kharishot B'Kazan is what causes, right, the damage. Achalotav to the cherish kargarim. It's not the cherish and shote kazan that caused the damage. And if you leave a shore untied, or if you leave a boar uncovered, the damage has nothing to do with who you left watching the item. I mean, that cherish shote kazan, they're irrelevant to the picture. You left something in a position where it could do damage, and they become irrelevant to the picture. Therefore, you are chayav for the shore and the boar. By shall have it, right, still takes the Sevet, when we call over here, Sevet means tongs, but the grabbing and the holding of the Kereshot Bekadon are the cause of the damage. Why? Because they've got to bring the fire to the fuel. I mean, there still has to be, there's an additional action needed to cause damage here. Suppose the shore and boar, which by nature now, once the shore is untied and the boar is uncovered, they will cause damage without any additional effort or action. Right? Whereas by the Shalhevet, it still requires an additional action, which is the Kereshot Bekadon to take the fire to fuel. And because of that extra step, in that case, where you'll be according to Rabbi Yochanan Patur mi Dine Adam, but to Shor and Bor, well, you'll be Chayav mi Dine Adam. There, we'll stop here because these are comparing goes all the way halfway through the next Talmud, so I don't think it's worth starting the next Sugya. We'll stop over here. All right.